So it is that the cosmic symbols are presented in a spirit of thought-bewildering sublime paradox. The kingdom of God is within, yet without. Life is sleep, death the awakening. The hero, the waker of his own soul, is himself but the convenient means of his own dissolution. Perhaps the most eloquent possible symbol of this mystery is that of the God crucified. Read in one direction, the meaning is the passage of the phenomenal hero into superconsciousness. The body with its five senses is left hanging on the cross of the knowledge of life and death. But also, God has descended voluntarily and taken upon himself this phenomenal agony. God assumes the life of man, and man releases the God within himself at the midpoint of the cross arms, the same sun door through which God descends and man ascends, each as the other's food.
Now the interesting thing is that with the Christian tradition, Christ's cross is called the tree of immortal life, Holyrood. Christ, as it were, went through that gate, and he now hangs on that tree as the fruit of the tree himself, the fruit of immortal life. And when we go to communion and take the bread, which is Christ's body and blood, we are eating of the fruit of immortal life and thus achieving immortality. Christ is in exactly the same position, the same place as the Buddha, who is the guide and opener of the way to the tree of immortal life. In the Middle Ages, there was a very beautiful image of Christ on the cross. He's on the mountain of the skull, Golgotha, or Calvary. Under the cross is the skull, after which the mountain is named. Whose skull is it? It's Adam's skull. And the blood of Christ falling on that skull baptizes, as it were, the whole human race. But this image of a cross growing from a skull is a very interesting one. Throughout Polynesia, there are no serpents in Polynesia. There are only eels. The eel plays the role of the serpent. And there's a very amusing series of stories that have to do with an eel that fell in love with a girl who frequently bathed in the pool where he used to swim around. And one fine day, he just scraped up against her leg, and she became aware of him, and presently he became her lover, and he could turn into a charming young man just as the serpent kings could. Well, one fine day, he said, "Now, next time I come to you this way, you must cut my head off before I've turned into a man and bury that head." And indeed, although she didn't like to do it, she did cut his head off, buried the head, and there grew from that head the coconut tree, and you can see the head in the coconuts. This is the fruit. The coconut tree is symbolic of the fruit of life. I am the food of the world, and it has grown from the head of the beheaded serpent. And so we have the head and the tree, the skull and the cross, and you have also seen those images of the cross with the serpent up it, and the text is from the John Gospel. As Moses lifted the serpent in the desert to save men from the poison of the serpents, so the serpent Christ shall be lifted as a serpent.
The philosophical formula illustrated by the cosmogonic cycle is that of the circulation of consciousness through the three planes of being. The first plane is that of waking experience. The second plane is that of dream experience. The third plane is that of deep sleep. In the first are encountered the instructive experiences of life. In the second, these are digested, assimilated to the inner forces of the dreamer, while in the third, all is enjoyed and known unconsciously in the space within the heart, the room of the inner controller, the source and end of all. The cosmogonic cycle is to be understood as the passage of universal consciousness from the deep sleep zone of the unmanifest through dream to the full day of waking, then back again through dream to the timeless dark. The cosmogonic cycle pulses forth into manifestation and back into non-manifestation amidst a silence of the unknown. The Hindus represent this mystery in the holy syllable Aum.
Is the concept that is epitomized in the syllable Om, which refers to the four levels of consciousness. And it's these whole four levels that are involved in this hero journey. We go from the first level through the second to the third, fourth, and then back again. This syllable Om is analyzed into A, U, and M. In Sanskrit, the syllable O is analyzed as A and U, a combination of A and U. So we have three syllables here, A, U, and M. And this is called, in India, the four-syllabled word. The fourth syllable we'll come to a little later. The A, well, when one pronounces this syllable, it starts in the back of the mouth, ah, oo, mm, om. It's supposed to be pronounced in such a way that it will have filled the whole mouth with sound. And then it is said that all the vowels are simply inflections of om, and the consonants are simply interruptions of the vowel sound, so that all words are involved in om. The A is allegorically interpreted as referring to waking consciousness. In waking consciousness, subject and object are separate from each other. I see you. You hear me. There is a separation of subject and object. This is the realm of duality. And this is the way consciousness thinks. The objects, furthermore, are gross objects. They are not self-luminous. They have to be illuminated from without. U is referred to dream consciousness, and here there is a totally different logic. You see your own dream, and you're surprised by it. You are the subject that sees the dream, and you are also, your will, the object that is the dream, so that the subject and object, though they seem to be separate, are the same. Aristotelian logic fails here. Now, it's the Indian notion that the world of dream and the world of the heavens, purgatories, and hells is the same world. Hell, purgatory, and heaven are of dream consciousness. The images are self-luminous. The images are in rapid flux. They are and they are not. I mean, there's another kind of reality here. Is the level of deep, dreamless sleep. Here all is darkness, and consciousness is latent. But that consciousness which is latent is not a consciousness of any specific object. Now the goal of yoga is to go into deep sleep awake, so that you will not experience darkness there, but consciousness. Consciousness not associated with any specific object. Neither with a waking consciousness object, nor with a dream consciousness object, but simply pure consciousness, which is what all of us simply are. That is the fourth syllable of Om. And that is the silence that surrounds Om. It was there first, it was afterwards, it is underneath. Now that is to be experienced. It can't be seen, it can't be thought. That is the transcendent mystery that is behind and within and is the essence of all things. And it is the experiencing of that that is the experience of oneness. But one is not to suppose that one is operating on the level of the silence when one's awake and talking to one's friends or when one's walking down the street.
The syllable itself is God as creator, preserver, destroyer, but the silence is God eternal, absolutely uninvolved in all the opening and closing of the round. Myth represents this cycle as surrounded and permeated by silence. Myth is a directing of the mind and heart to that ultimate mystery which fills and surrounds all existences. Even in the most comical and apparently frivolous of its moments, mythology is directing the mind to this unmanifest, which is just beyond the eye. We read in a Kabbalistic text of the medieval Hebrews, "The aged of the aged, the unknown of the unknown, has a form and yet has no form. He has a form whereby the universe is preserved, and yet has no form because he cannot be comprehended." This aged of the aged is represented as a face in profile, always in profile, because the hidden side can never be known. This is called the great face, makroprosopos. From the strands of its white beard, the entire world proceeds. The white beard of makroprosopos descends over another head, the little face, mikroprosopos, represented full face and with a beard of black. And whereas the eye of the great face is without lid and never shuts, the eyes of the little face open and close in a slow rhythm of universal destiny. This is the opening and closing of the cosmogonic round. The little face is named God. The great face is named I Am. Makroprosopos is the uncreated, uncreating, and Mikroprosopos, the uncreated, creating. The cosmogonic cycle unrolls the great vision of the creation and destruction of the world. In the following, the cosmogonic cycle is broken down into four stages. The first stage is entitled Emanations, and it treats of the coming of the forms of the universe out of the void. The Hebrew Kabbalah represents the process of creation as a series of emanations out of the I Am of the Great Face. The first is the head itself, in profile, and from this proceed nine splendid lights. The emanations are represented also as the branches of a cosmic tree, which is upside down, rooted in the inscrutable height. The world that we see is the reverse image of that tree. According to the Indian Samkhya philosophers, the void condenses into the element ether, or space. From this, air is precipitated. From air comes fire, from fire water, and from water the element earth. An amusing Chinese myth personifies these emanating elements as five venerable sages who come stepping out of a ball of chaos, suspended in the void. Before heaven and earth had become separated from each other, everything was a great ball of mist called chaos. At that time, the spirits of the five elements took shape and then developed into five ancients. The first was called the Yellow Ancient, and he was the master of earth. The second was called the Red Ancient, and he was the master of fire. The third was called the Dark Ancient, and he was the master of water. The fourth was called the Wood Prince, and he was the master of wood. The fifth was called the Metal Mother, and she was the mistress of metals. Now each of these five ancients set in motion the primordial spirit from which he had proceeded, so that water and earth sank downward, the heavens soared aloft, and the earth became fast in the depths. Then the water gathered into rivers and lakes, and the mountains and plains appeared. The heavens cleared, and the earth divided. Then there were sun, moon, and all the stars, sand, clouds, rain, and dew. The Yellow Ancient gave play to the purest power of the earth, and to this were added the operations of fire and water. Then there sprang into being the grasses and trees, birds and animals, and the generation of the snakes and insects and fishes and turtles. The Wood Prince and the Metal Mother brought light and darkness together and thereby created the human race as man and woman. Thus, gradually appeared the world. The first effect of the cosmogonic emanations is the framing of the world stage of space. The second is the production of life within the frame. It is possible to represent the entire process in sexual terms as a pregnancy and a birth. About the middle of the 19th century, Paiore, a high chieftain of the Polynesian island of Ana, drew a picture of the beginning of creation. The first detail of this illustration was a little circle containing two elements, Tetumu, the foundation, a male, and Tepapa, the stratum rock, a female. The universe, said Paiore, was like an egg which contained Tetumu and Tepapa. At last it burst and produced three layers superimposed, one layer below supporting two above. On the lowest layer remained Tetumu and Tepapa, who created man, animals, and plants. The first man was Matata, produced without arms. He died shortly after he had come into being. The second was Aitu, who came with one arm but without legs, and he, like his elder brother, died. Finally, the third man was Hoatea, and he was perfectly formed. After this came a woman named Hoatu. She became the wife of Hoatea, and from them descended the human race. When the lowest layer of earth became filled with creation, the people made an opening in the middle of the layer above, so that they could get upon it also, and there they established themselves, taking with them plants and animals from below. Then they raised the third layer, so it should form a ceiling to the second, and ultimately established themselves up there too, so that human beings had three abodes. Above the earth were the skies, reaching down and supported by their respective horizons, and the people continued to work, expanding one sky above another in the same manner until all were set in order. The image of the cosmic egg is known to many mythologies. It appears in the Greek Orphic, Egyptian, Finnish, Buddhistic, and Japanese. The shell of the cosmic egg is the world frame of space, while the fertile seed power within typifies the inexhaustible life dynamism of nature. An Egyptian myth reveals the demiurge creating the world by an act of masturbation. A Hindu myth displays him in yogic meditation, with the forms of his inner vision breaking forth from him, to his own astonishment, and standing then around him as a pantheon of brilliant gods. In yet another account from India, the All-Father is represented as first splitting into male and female, then procreating all the creatures according to kind. In the beginning, this universe was only the self in human form. He looked around and saw nothing but himself. Then, at the beginning, he cried out, "I am He," whence came the name I. That is why, even today, when a person is addressed, he first declares, "It is I," and then announces the other name that he goes by. He was afraid. That is why people are afraid to be alone. He thought, "But what am I afraid of? There is nothing but myself." Whereupon, his fear was gone. He was unhappy. That is why people are not happy when they are alone. He wanted a mate. He became as big as a woman and man embracing. He divided this body, which was himself, into two parts. From that there came husband and wife. Therefore this human body, before one marries a wife, is like one of the halves of a split pea. He united with her, and from that were born men. She considered, "How can he unite with me after producing me from himself? Well then, let me hide myself." She became a cow, but he became a bull and united with her. From that were born cattle. She became a mare, he a stallion. She became a she-ass, he a he-ass, and united with her. From that union were born the one-hoofed animals. She became a she-goat, he a he-goat. She became a ewe, he a ram, and united with her. From that were born goats and sheep. Thus did he project everything that exists in pairs, down to the ants. Then he knew, "Indeed, I am myself the creation, for I have projected the entire world." Whence he was called creation. The Breaking of the One into the Manifold. The forward roll of the cosmogonic round precipitates the one into the many. In Paiori's chart, the people emerge from the lower darknesses and immediately go to work to elevate the sky. They hold councils, they decide, they plan, they take over the work of arranging the world. Yet we know that behind the scenes, the unmoved mover is at work, like a puppet master. In mythology, wherever the unmoved mover holds the center of attention, there is a miraculous spontaneity about the shaping of the universe. But when the perspective shifts to focus on living beings, then a sudden transformation overshadows the cosmic scene. The props of the universal stage have to be adjusted, even beaten into shape. The demiurge forces give up the initiative and even set themselves against the further progress of the cosmogonic round. Ranji, the sky, lay so close on the belly of Papa, Mother Earth, that the children could not break free from the womb. They were in an unstable condition, floating about the world of darkness, and this was their appearance. Some were crawling, some were upright with their arms held up, some lying on their sides, some on their backs, some were stooping, some with their heads bent down, some with their legs drawn up, some kneeling, some feeling about in the dark. They were all within the embrace of Ranji and Papa. At last the beings who had been begotten by heaven and earth, worn out by the continued darkness, consulted among themselves, saying, "Let us now determine what we should do with Ranji and Papa, whether it would be better to slay them or to rend them apart." Then spake Tu Matuenga, the fiercest of the children of heaven and earth, "It is well, let us slay them." Then spake Tane Mahuta, the father of the forests and of all things that inhabit them, or that are constructed from trees, "Nay, not so. It is better to rend them apart, and to let the heavens stand far above us and the earth lie under our feet. Let the sky become a stranger to us, but the earth remain close to us as our nursing mother." Several of the brother gods vainly tried to rend apart the heavens and the earth. At last it was Tane Mahuta himself who succeeded in the titanic project. His head is now firmly planted on his mother, the earth. His feet he raises up and rests against his father, the skies. He strains his back and limbs with mighty effort. Now are rent apart Ranji and Papa, and with cries and groans of woe they shriek aloud, "Wherefore slay you thus your parents? Why commit you so dreadful a crime as to slay us, as to rend your parents apart?" But Tane Mahuta pauses not. He regards not their shrieks and cries. Far, far beneath him, he presses down the earth. Far, far above him, he thrusts up the sky. But if these deeds of the desperate children seem violent, they are as nothing compared with the total carving up of the parent power which we discover recorded in the Icelandic Eddas. According to the Eddic account, after the yawning gap had given forth in the north a mist world of cold, and in the south a region of fire, and after the heat from the south had played on the rivers of ice that crowded down from the north, a yeasty venom began to be exuded. From this, a drizzle arose, which in turn congealed to rime. The rime melted and dripped. Life was quickened from the drippings in the form of a torpid, gigantic, hermaphroditic, horizontal figure named Ymir. The giant slept, and as it slept, it sweated. One of its feet begat with the other a son, while under its left hand germinated a man and wife. The rime continually melted and dripped, and there condensed from it the cow Odumla. From her udder flowed four streams of milk, which were drunk for nourishment by Ymir. But the cow, for her own nourishment, licked the ice blocks, which were salty. The evening of the first day she licked, a man's hair came forth from the blocks. The second day, a man's head. The third, the entire man was there, and his name was Buri. Now Buri had a son named Bor, who married one of the giant daughters of the creatures that had sprung from Ymir. She gave birth to the trinity of Odin, Vili, and Vi. And these then slaughtered sleepful Ymir and carved the body into chunks. Of Ymir's flesh the earth was fashioned, and of his sweat the sea. Crags of his bones, trees of his hair, and of his skull the sky. Then of his bones the blithe gods made Midgard for sons of men, and of his brain the bitter-mooded clouds were all created. To the Greeks, the titan Kronos castrated his father with a sickle and pushed him up out of the way. In Egyptian iconography, the position of the cosmic couple is inverted. The sky is the mother, the father the vitality of the earth. But the pattern of the myth remains. The two were pushed asunder by their child, the air god Shu. According to the Sumerians, first came the primeval ocean. The primeval ocean generated the cosmic mountain, which consisted of heaven and earth united. An, the heaven father, and Ki, the earth mother, produced Enlil, the air god, who presently separated An from Ki and then united himself with his mother to beget humankind.
The goddess is the world lotus. The lotus is likened to the woman's womb. And the whole of space and the round of time is exactly the walls of that womb, so that we're all in there. And all the deities that are in form are inside the goddess herself, so that actually they're operating as though she were operating. I often think of this when I read that Babylonian myth of Marduk, who killed Tiamat, the mother of the gods, and then cut her up and fashioned the world out of her. If he'd waited a minute, she'd have done it herself. But then I think what a wonderful mother she is. She let the little boy think he did it.
In the Babylonian version, the hero is Marduk, the sun god. The victim is Tiamat, a female personification of the original abyss itself. Then the Lord raised the thunderbolt, his mighty weapon, and against Tiamat, who was raging, thus he sent the word. Thou art become great, thou hast exalted thyself on high, and thy heart hath prompted thee to call to battle. Let thy weapons be girded on, stand, I and thou, let us join battle. When Tiamat heard these words, she was like one possessed, she lost her reason. Then Tiamat advanced, and the Lord spread out his net and caught her, and the evil wind that was behind him he let loose in her face. The terrible winds filled her belly, and her courage was taken from her, and her mouth opened wide. He seized the trident and burst her belly. He severed her inward parts. He pierced her heart. He overcame her and cut off her life. And with his merciless club he smashed her skull. He cut through the channels of her blood, and he made the north wind bear it away into secret places. Then Marduk rested, gazing upon her dead body, and devised a cunning plan. He split her up like a flat fish into two halves. One half of her he established as a covering for heaven. He fixed a bolt. he stationed a watchman and bade them not to let her waters come forth. Marduk in this heroic manner pushed back with a ceiling the waters above, and with a floor the waters beneath. Then in the world between he created man. The myths never tire of illustrating the point that conflict in the created world is not what it seems. Tiamat, though slain and dismembered, was not thereby undone. Had the battle been viewed from another angle, the monster would have been seen to shatter of her own accord. From the standpoint of Marduk, all seemed accomplished as by a mighty arm amid danger and pain. But from the center of the emanating presence, the flesh was yielded willingly, and the hand that carved it was ultimately no more than an agent of the will of the victim herself. Herein lies the basic paradox of myth, the paradox of the dual focus. As at the beginning of the cosmogonic cycle, it was possible to say, God is not involved, but at the same time, God is creator, preserver, destroyer. So now, at this critical juncture, where the one breaks into the many, destiny happens, but at the same time, destiny is brought about. The simplicity of the folk mythologies stand in sharp contrast to the profoundly suggestive myths of the cosmogonic cycle. Old man was traveling about, declare the Blackfeet of Montana. He was making people and arranging things. He came from the south, traveling north, making animals and birds as he passed along. He made the mountains, prairies, timber, and the brush first. So he went along, traveling northward, making things as he went, putting rivers here and there and falls on them, putting red paint here and there in the ground, fixing up the world as we see it today. He made the Milk River and crossed it, and being tired, went up on a hill and lay down to rest. As he lay on his back, stretched out on the ground, with his arms extended, he marked himself out with stones, the shape of his body, head, legs, arms, and everything. There you can see those rocks today. After he had rested, he went on northward and stumbled over a knoll and fell on his knees. Then he said, "You are a bad thing to be stumbling against." So he raised up two large buttes there and named them the Knees, and so they are called to this day. He went further north, and with some of the rocks he carried with him, he built the Sweet Grass Hills. One day, Old Man determined that he would make a woman and a child, so he formed them both, the woman and the child, her son, of clay. After he had molded the clay in human shape, he said to the clay, "You must be people," and then he covered it up and left it and went away. The next morning, he went to the place and took the covering off and saw that the clay shapes had changed a little. The second morning, there was still more change, and the third, still more. The fourth morning, he went to the place, took the covering off, looked at the images, and told them to rise and walk, and they did so. They walked to the river with their maker, and he told them that his name was Old Man. As they were standing by the river, the woman said to him, "How is it? Will we always live? Will there be no end of it?" He said, "I've never thought of that. We will have to decide it. I will take this buffalo chip and throw it in the river. If it floats, when people die, in 4 days they will become alive again. They will die for only 4 days. But if it sinks, there will be an end to them." He threw the chip in the river and it floated. The woman turned and picked up a stone and said, "No, I will throw this stone in the river. If it floats, we will always live. If it sinks, people must die so that they may always be sorry for each other." The woman threw the stone into the water and it sank. "There," said Old Man, "you have chosen. There will be an end to them." The arranging of the world, the creation of man, and the decision about death are typical themes from the tales of the primitive creator. The Maoris, for example, from whom we have some of our finest cosmogonies, have the story of an egg dropped by a bird into the primeval sea. It burst, and out came a man, a woman, a boy, a girl, a pig, a dog, and a canoe. All got into the canoe and drifted to New Zealand. This clearly is a burlesque of the cosmic egg. A clown figure, working in opposition to the creator, very often appears in myth and folk tale as accounting for the ills and difficulties of existence. The Melanesians of New Britain tell of an obscure being, the one who was first there, who drew two male figures on the ground, scratched open his own skin, and sprinkled the drawings with his blood. He plucked two large leaves and covered the figures, which became, after a while, two men. The names of the men were To Kabinana and To Karvuvu. To Kabinana went off alone, climbed a coconut tree that had light yellow nuts, picked two that were still unripe and threw them to the ground. They broke and became two handsome women. Tokarvuvu admired the women and asked, how had his brother come by them? Climb a coconut tree, Tokabinana said. Pick two unripe nuts and throw them to the ground. But Tokarvuvu threw his nuts point downward, and the women who came forth from them had flat, ugly noses. Then one day, Tokabinana carved a thumfish out of wood and let it swim off into the ocean, so that it should be a living fish forever after. Now this thumfish drove the Malivaran fish to the shore, where Tokabinana simply gathered them up from the beach. Tokarvuvu admired the thumfish and wanted to make one, but when he was taught how, he carved a shark instead. This shark ate the Malivaran fish instead of driving them ashore. Tokarvuvu, crying, went to his brother and said, I wish I had not made that fish. He does nothing but eat up all the others. What sort of fish is it? He was asked. Well, he answered, I made a shark. You really are a disgusting fellow, his brother said. Now you have fixed it so that our mortal descendants shall suffer. That fish of yours will eat up all the others and people too. Behind this foolishness, it is possible to see that one cause, the obscure being who cut himself in half, yields within the frame of the world dual effects, good and evil. The story is not as naive as it appears. Universal, too, is the casting of the antagonist, the representative of evil in the role of the clown. Devils symbolize the inevitable imperfections of the realm of shadow, and so long as we remain this side, the veil cannot be done away. The Black Tatars of Siberia say that when the demiurge Pajna fashioned the first human beings, he found that he was unable to produce a life-giving spirit for them. So he had to go up to heaven and procure souls from Kudai, the high god, leaving meanwhile a naked dog to guard the figures of his manufacture. The devil, Erlik, arrived while he was away, and Erlik said to the dog, Thou hast no hair. I will give thee golden hair if thou wilt give into my hands these soulless people. The proposal pleased the dog, and he gave the people he was guarding to the tempter. Erlik defiled them with his spittle, but took flight the moment he saw God approaching to give them life. God saw what he had done, and so he turned the human bodies inside out. And that is why we have spittle and impurity in our intestines. The folk mythologies do not differ from the great mythologies on any essential point in their evaluations of human circumstance. Their symbolic personages correspond to those of the higher iconographies, and the world in which they move is the same world, the world and the age between deep sleep and waking consciousness, the zone where the one breaks into the manifold and the many are reconciled in the one. Mother Universe, the second stage of the cycle, is typified by the virgin birth and is a review of the creative and redemptive roles of the female power, first on a cosmic scale as the mother of the universe, then again on the human plane as the mother of the hero. The world-generating spirit of the father passes into the manifold of earthly experience through a transforming medium, the mother of the world.
Shiva is probably the oldest deity now worshipped in the world. He belongs to the very early folk traditions of India, and the first appearance of a deity who is probably Shiva is in the Dravidian period of about 2500 to 1500 BC. And he is the lord, in the first place, of the phallus. The principal object of worship for Shiva is the lingam, always represented in conjunction with the yoni, or the female symbol, as though penetrating it from below. So that when we are revering this symbol, what we're revering is the pouring of divine cosmic energy into the goddess womb, which is the space in which we all dwell. And his principal animal is the bull, which is always a early Bronze Age symbol. And another attitude of his is that of yoga. Since he brings forth the world, he can also dismiss it. He dismisses it in yoga. That's Shiva. And so he is the Lord creator, preserver, and destroyer.
In mythologies emphasizing the maternal rather than the paternal aspect of the creator, this original female fills the world stage in the beginning, playing the roles that are elsewhere assigned to males. And she is virgin, because her spouse is the invisible unknown. A strange representation of this figure is to be found in the mythology of the Finns. In Runo E of the Kalevala, it is told how the virgin daughter of the air descended from the sky mansions into the primeval sea, and there for centuries floated on the everlasting waters. Then a storm arose in fury from the east, a mighty tempest, and the sea was wildly foaming, and the waves dashed ever higher. Thus the tempest rocked the virgin, and the billows drove the maiden o'er the ocean's azure surface, on the crest of foaming billows, till the wind that blew around her and the sea woke life within her. For 7 centuries the water mother floated with the child in her womb, unable to give it birth. She prayed to Ukko, the highest god, and he sent a teal to build its nest on her knee. The teal's eggs fell from the knee and broke. The fragments formed the earth, sky, sun, moon, and clouds. Then the water mother, floating still, herself began the work of the world shaper. When the 9th year had passed, and the summer 10th was passing, from the sea her head she lifted, and her forehead she uplifted. And she then began creation, and she brought the world to order on the open ocean's surface, on the far extending waters. Wheresoever her hand she pointed, there she formed the jutting headlands. Wheresoever her feet she rested, there she formed the caves for fishes. When she dived beneath the water, there she formed the depths of ocean. When toward the land she turned, there the level shores extended. Where her feet to land extended, spots were formed for salmon netting. Where her head the land touched lightly, there the curving bays extended. Further from the land she floated, and abode in open water, and created rocks in ocean, and the reefs that eyes behold not, where the ships are often shattered, and the sailors' lives are ended. But the babe remained in her body, growing toward a sentimental middle age. Still unborn was Wainamoinen, still unborn the bard immortal. Wainamoinen, old and steadfast, rested in his mother's body for the space of 30 summers and the sum of 30 winters, ever on the placid waters and upon the foaming billows. So he pondered and reflected how he could continue living in a resting place so gloomy, in a dwelling far too narrow, where he could not see the moonlight, nor could he behold the sunlight. Then he spake the words which follow and expressed his thoughts in this wise. Aid me, moon and sun, release me, and the great bear lend his counsel, through the portal that I know not, through the unaccustomed passage, from the little nest that holds me, from a dwelling place so narrow, to the land conduct the roamer, to the open air conduct me, to behold the moon in heaven, and the splendor of the sunlight, see the great bear's stars above me, and the shining stars in heaven. When the moon no freedom gave him, neither did the sun release him, then he wearied of existence, and his life became a burden. Thereupon he moved the portal. With his finger, fourth in number, opened quick the bony gateway, with the toes upon his left foot, with his knees beyond the gateway. Headlong in the water falling, with his hands the waves repelling, thus the man remained in ocean, and the hero on the billows. Before Wainamoinen, hero already at his birth, could make his way ashore, the ordeal of a second mother womb remained for him, that of the elemental cosmic ocean. Unprotected now, he had to undergo the initiation of nature's fundamentally inhuman forces. On the level of water and wind, he had to experience again what he already knew so well. In the 5 years he sojourned, waited 5 years, waited 6 years, 7 years also, even 8 years, on the surface of the ocean by a nameless promontory near a barren, treeless country. On the land his knees he planted, and upon his arms he rested, rose that he might view the moonbeams and enjoy the pleasant sunlight, see the great bear's stars above him and the shining stars in heaven. Thus was ancient Wainamoinen he, the ever-famous minstrel, born of the divine creatrix, born of Ilmatar, his mother. The universal goddess makes her appearance to men under a multitude of guises. The mother of life is at the same time the mother of death. She is masked in the ugly demonesses of famine and disease. The Sumero-Babylonian astral mythology identified the aspects of the cosmic female with the phases of the planet Venus. As morning star, she was the virgin. As evening star, the harlot, as lady of the night, the consort of the moon, and when extinguished under the blaze of the sun, she was the hag of hell. A myth from Southeast Africa displays the aspects of the Venus Mother in coordination with the first stages of the cosmogonic cycle. Here, the original man is the moon, the morning star his first wife, the evening star his second. Just as Wainamoinen emerged from the womb by his own act, so the moon man emerges from the abyssal waters. He and his wives are to be the parents of the creatures of the earth. The story comes to us as follows. Maori, who was God, made the first man and called him Muetsi, the moon. He put him on the bottom of Disvoa, the lake, and gave him a ngona horn filled with ngona oil. Muetsi lived in Disvoa. Muetsi said to Maori, "I want to go to the earth." Maori said, "You will rue it." Muetsi said, "Nonetheless, I want to go on the earth." Maori said, "Then go on the earth." The earth was cold and empty. There were no grasses, no bushes, no trees. There were no animals. Muetsi wept and said to Maori, "How shall I live here?" Maori said, "I warned you. You have started on the path at the end of which you shall die. I will, however, give you one of your kind." Maori gave Muetsi a maiden who was called Masasi, the morning star. Maori said, "Masasi shall be your wife for 2 years." Maori gave Masasi a fire maker. In the evening, Muetsi went into a cave with Masasi. Masasi said, "Help me, we will make a fire." Muetsi twirled the rusika. When the fire was lighted, Muetsi lay down on one side of it, Masasi on the other. The fire burned between them. When it was night, Muetsi took his ngona horn. He moistened his index finger with a drop of ngona oil. Muetsi jumped over the fire. Muetsi touched Masasi's body with the ointment on his finger. Then Muetsi went back to his bed and slept. When Muetsi wakened in the morning, he looked over to Masasi. Muetsi saw that Masasi's body was swollen. When day broke, Masasi began to bear. Masasi bore grasses. Masasi bore bushes. Masasi bore trees. Masasi did not stop bearing till the earth was covered with grasses, bushes, and trees. The trees grew. They grew till their tops touched the sky. When the tops of the trees touched the sky, it began to rain. Muetsi and Masasi lived in plenty. They had fruits and grain. Muetsi built a house. Muetsi made an iron shovel. Muetsi made a hoe and planted crops. Masasi plaited fish traps and caught fish. Masasi fetched wood and water. Masasi cooked. Thus Muetsi and Masasi lived for 2 years. After 2 years, Maori said to Masasi, "The time is up." Maori took Masasi from the earth and put her back in Disvoa. Muetsi wailed. He wailed and wept and said to Maori, "What shall I do without Masasi? Who will fetch wood and water for me? Who will cook for me?" 8 days long, Muetsi wept. Then Maori said, "I have warned you that you are going to your death, but I will give you another woman. I will give you Morongo, the evening star. Morongo will stay with you for 2 years. Then I shall take her back again."